Mark, it's a pleasure to have you here.
I'm very glad to be here.
Well, let's start by being provocative. Okay. How did a white boy like you ever get so involved with the study of African-American culture and history?
I grew up in Crown Heights in the 1950s at the time that it was undergoing a very dramatic change in its racial composition, a change which really polarized the community. I grew up in the early 50s when there wasn't a visible race problem. Crown Heights was a Jewish and Italian community. Perhaps 1 or 2% of the population was black. And the Jewish population, at least on the surface, was very racially tolerant. They welcomed the Jackie Robinson Dodgers. Racial epithets were not used in my presence. The term, when people were talking about blacks, they'd use the term schwarz, so they actually went into Yiddish. I was there when integrated sports were, you know, capturing the imagination of the neighborhood. I was there when rock and roll was doing the same. But then, by the time I entered high school, the neighborhood became very tense. I went to a local high school which had about 20% of its students African American, many of them coming down by bus from Bedford-Stuyvesant. There were fights outside the school. There were fights in the school. I got in a locker room fight with six black kids. It led me being knocked out cold and ended up going to a school out of the district. And my parents, who had not talked about race very much when I was, you know, 8 or 9 or 10, by the time I was 13 or 14, becoming very visibly angry about the changing racial composition of the neighborhood. And their anger came to a head for the first time when I was in high school and decided to participate in my first civil rights demonstration, which was being organized by the Erasmus Hall High School chapter of the Congress of Racial Equality, which was joining Brooklyn Core in picketing Ebbinger's Bakery, this bakery chain, which refused to hire African Americans as truck drivers or people working in the stores, even though many of their stores were now being located in black neighborhoods. And when I went to this demonstration, my parents hit the ceiling, said, one, that I could get in trouble for going to a demonstration because in their era, people lost their jobs because of this, but two, I shouldn't be doing something to help black people. I should be doing something to help the Jews if I wanted to help somebody. And it was clear that they saw African Americans as a threat to their neighborhood, their security, in ways that upset me. When I went to college, I also became involved in the chapter of CORE at Columbia. Was watching with great concern and dismay at the violence that greeted civil rights demonstrators in the South. Also was disturbed by how race played itself out in the Columbia campus. There were some Southern students at Columbia who were openly racist. Columbia itself had this very contemptuous attitude towards Harlem. Had also displaced many people of color from the neighborhood. And so I looked around me and saw an extension of the racial issues that I was seeing in my own neighborhood, which seemed to really divide people, and of course was now dividing the whole country. So when I started taking history classes in American history, I decided to do my research papers on subjects relating to race. The first big research paper I did was on the disfranchisement of the Negro in Alabama in the early 20th century, when The Alabama Constitutional Convention was debating whether to overturn the Reconstruction actions, which had placed African Americans in position as voters and as office holders, and basically eliminate them from politics and establish a formal segregation code. And so that was my first research venture into the study of race, and it was a fascinating experience. I loved going back into the past. It was, I think, 1903, and I was at the convention, and the issue seemed so alive to me that I said, well, this is the kind of history I wanted to do. And I got some encouragement from this. I mean, this was a time at Columbia, there were no courses in African American history. I don't ever recall reading a book by an African American author, but I had professors who encouraged this interest, particularly Walter Metzger, who really, you know, every time I took a course with him and wanted to do this kind of research, he encouraged it. So I was moving in this direction, based upon my experience in Brooklyn, based upon what I was seeing, you know, experiencing at Columbia, based upon what I was watching in the news. But the thing that really pushed me into this was what happened to me when I was a senior at Columbia. And I met an African-American woman at a basketball team party at Columbia. We started, you know, dating, and then I fell in love with her. And when I told my parents, they reacted with a level of hysteria that just blew me away. They had no interest in this young woman's background, character, personality, accomplishments. Just the fact that she was black meant that they would have nothing to do with her. And they basically told me she could never be part of our family. And they would see me, but never with her, and basically said that I was destroying everything that they had worked for in their lives. Now, this experience, and parenthetically, I was adopted by her extended family of transplanted Southerners. That experience made me feel that race was the overwhelming issue in American society that we as a nation were unable to deal with, not only at the level of politics, but at the level of folk culture mores. And as an intellectual, if I was going to do anything to make a difference, it was to find the language, find the images, to try to understand the force of this in people's lives. So I said, I've got a subject that will keep me busy for a lifetime. I wish that I didn't have the momentum and drive for this interest coming from this experience, but, you know, it did, and it's something that's never left me.
But it strikes me when even in becoming involved in an interracial relationship, there must have been an awful lot of psychological preparation of you because of the people you've come in contact with, the readings you've done, the influences to make you enter an interracial
right.
relationship. So you're suggesting that experience itself was a shaping experience. But were there factors before that led you to be willing to enter into
it? Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, clearly, you know, growing up, there were a lot of things that probably contributed to this. Growing up as a child with black heroes in sports and music, having taken the step of participating in civil rights demonstrations against my parents' wishes, having, spent some time in college being involved in the civil rights movement and also studying African American history probably prepared me for staying with the relationship once it began to blossom. But I don't think I was looking for an interracial relationship. I think that it was something I stumbled into accidentally. I was looking for companionship. I wasn't looking for interracial companionship. I didn't expect to fall in love. But when I did, all of these things predisposed me not to give in to the pressures that I was feeling from my parents, from people in the street, later from African-American students who became politicized in the Black Power movement and began to question it. So I think that I was predisposed to respond, but I think that a lot of the things that happened to me were accidental things that happened to young people, you know, when they meet. Nor was I the only person who this, you know, happened to. I think I was one of the few people who was also planned to be a historian. I mean, I had decided I was going to be a historian before I got in the relationship. The relationship added a layer of passion to that career choice, if not obsession, that I think wouldn't have otherwise been there.
What actually led you to decide to be a historian?
Both of my parents were teachers, and I grew up thinking that teaching was a wonderful, you know, way of life. I think that the first experience that made me want to be a historian was actually in a European history course I took as a sophomore with this amazing lecturer named Paul Noyes, who unfortunately died of cancer, you know, at a very young age. He was doing the French Revolution and European revolutions, and made you feel like you were living in the revolution. And it was so exciting to see somebody take 200 people and make them feel chills going through them when he spoke. But then I did a paper on the Paris Commune where I got the original minutes of the Paris Commune in French. And as I read through this, and I remember they were in the New York Public Library on 42nd Street, I just felt chills going through me, you know, even more than I felt in the classroom. It was like, my God, I'm entering in the past, you know, and research of a certain kind just energized me, my imagination, my intellect, and made me feel like nothing else had ever done. And so I said, you know, if I can combine this research experience with the capacity to move people and make them feel and think the way, you know, this man could do, wouldn't that be a great way to live? So I think it was a combination of that. And then I had the same experience when I did that paper on the disfranchisement of the Negro in Alabama. Going through original documents excited me because it enabled me to enter into a different time and place.
Now, you went to Columbia in 1962.
Right.
And you finished in
66?
And you went immediately into the graduate program?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, you studied with some folks that I don't normally associate with radical history or history that focuses on racial issues. William Luchtenberg, Richard Hofstadter. What was it like being at – by this time, you considered yourself a radical?
Yeah.
What was it like for a radical to work with faculty members like William Luchtenberg and Richard Hofstadter?
William Luchtenberg was somebody who thought that I needed to come down a peg. I mean, he to some degree respected my passion, but also thought that I had an element of arrogance about my newfound political radicalism that needed to be checked a bit. But he did it in a very constructive way. Namely, he just tore up my prose, but in a way that helped me as a writer. In other words, whatever he might have brought to the table in terms of skepticism, his way of dealing with it mainly helped me improve my skills. Now, I'm a fairly thick-skinned person, so some people might have picked up what he had done and gotten discouraged or insulted, but I was probably so arrogant that, you know, the criticisms, the political criticisms, or the asides about my personal character didn't bother me. Richard Hofstadter, I think, identified with me because he had once been a radical. And he kind of liked the radical me, even though he thought portions of my radicalism were comical. I mean, he used to sort of make fun of me in a much more benign way. There was a little bit of an edge in William Lochtenberg. And with Hofstadter, it was more, you know, humor. He dealt with me more in terms of humor. And I found that I actually really enjoyed working with him. I mean, unfortunately, he also passed away soon after I began working with him. But I also, at this point, had a cohort of fellow students who was such a great source of support and camaraderie that, you know, I was able to say, okay, I mean, look, I've got two of the best known people in American history, you know, here working with me. This is going to help me. I'm not compromising anything. You know, they're telling me what they think. You know, I'm accepting the things that they're saying that can make me a better writer and a better historian. And I'm, you know, going about and doing what I'm doing. It seemed to me, again, because of the camaraderie at Columbia Graduate School among so many, you know, other people who were doing similar work, it was a good situation.
1966, 67, 68, while you're doing your graduate work, was some of the hottest years in the 60s in terms of student activism. And how, what were the distractions? That's not the right term. I want you to tell me, situate yourself in that time, and all of the different influences that were tearing you apart, okay, as a scholar and as a person.
Well, the first thing is, of course, the family situation I'm in. I mean, I see my parents every 2 weeks, you know, in this very tense encounter, and which is complicated the fact that my father has Hodgkin's disease, and which will, you know, ultimately take his life. And I, even after what they did to me, I felt responsible to help them out, even though there was never any reconciliation about my girlfriend. But then every weekend I'm going up to the Bronx to hang out with my girlfriend's sisters and their friends in a black working class setting, which is totally different than anything I've ever experienced. You know, these are working class people who, you know, they're eating different foods than I ever experienced. They're dancing to different music, and yet they completely accept, you know, my girlfriend and I. Then we're also having her younger brothers and sisters come live with us, and we're trying to put them through college. So I'm in this incredibly complicated family situation, which is both, you know, my father's dying of cancer and I'm dealing with this, and I'm in part of this black extended family, which is wonderfully supportive and somewhat tumultuous. And then I'm trying to do this graduate work, which I just became incredibly compartmentalized. I'd set aside certain hours I'd be in the Columbia Library doing my reading, and certain hours in the middle of the night when I would write, when no one else was up. But I also felt, you know, this is rough, but man, this is the real deal. I mean, you know, I'm 21, 22 years old. You know, I don't need sleep, and I'm living it. I mean, again, I'm feeling, I'm writing it, I'm living it. you know, what the, who, you know, this, and again, I was surrounded by love. You know, I was surrounded by many, many friends. I was surrounded by this loving family of people who accepted me unreservedly, and that enabled me to deal with the pain of rejection by my parents. Now, then the Vietnam War comes in, and that was, in some ways, the killer, because, you know, then there is this other, I mean, race alone was enough of a an obsession with me, but now we're dealing with something that not only threatens my life and that of, you know, my fellow students, but also could swallow up all the potential gains we need to be making here because of the resources that were being siphoned off. So I reluctantly become an anti-war activist also. And by that time, I mean, I don't know how the hell I don't know if I was sleeping. By 1968, you know, it's anti-war demonstrations, it's all these family responsibilities, and there's also the issue of a movement building at Columbia, which leads to the 68 demonstration. So it's a time of when the pressures start to build to the point where I really do get close to the cracking point when Martin Luther King is killed and my father dies and then Bobby Kennedy is killed and the Columbia 68 demonstrations. I don't know how I somehow kept from going under completely. You know, somehow there was a part of me that was determined to see this history thing through in spite of all of these other things going on. In retrospect, it seems incredible that I kept going. But it must have meant an awful lot. And one other thing. I think that what also made a difference is meeting Paul Buell and starting to write for Radical America. Because Paul contacted me when he heard about the senior thesis I had written about the rent strike movement in New York City, which I had read on WBAI. And when he had heard about that, he wanted it for Radical America. And eventually, you know, he published an edited version as an article. And then he wanted an article from my master's thesis in the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. And so all of a sudden, I feel, my God, people want what I'm doing as a historian. And they want it and because they think in some way it helps build the movement. And I think that's also very important, that I felt I had had, by 1968, I had had two articles published in Radical America and was feeling that my historical work is something that's important to my peers. You know, and maybe that also kept me going.
Most people probably are not familiar with Radical America. Maybe you can take some time to tell us about it.
Okay. Paul Buell was a graduate student in American history at the University of Wisconsin, just married, his wife Mary Jo, who's now an eminent, you know, scholar in women's studies and women's history. And he decided that it was really important at a time when the New Left was building, that it have some understanding of its history. So he started a magazine called Radical America, and it was called an SDS Journal of American Radicalism. It was identified specific. It was like an SDS project. And he was like an evangelist for the importance of understanding this history, and he found me, and it gave me a sense of purpose, and probably a bunch of other people. I mean, you know, again, my experience, you know, maybe some of the dimensions of it were unusual in terms of maybe this interracial relationship fueling this very focused passion. But there were a lot of people who were politicized in the 60s who were also you know, wanted to do history. And having a magazine which said you could do both, that the historical work could help the movement, that understanding the past experience of American radicalism, which had been erased from memory by the McCarthy era, was something important. And it was a terrific journal. I mean, a lot of people all over the country, most of whom were graduate students who were also activists, started writing for this. And people read it. I used to, you know, sell it at Columbia, peddle it to, like, you know, bookstores in Manhattan. There was a sense of excitement about uncovering a lost legacy of radical activism that Paul triggered, and it triggered something in me that kept me from going under. In retrospect, I could almost say Radical America saved my life, because there were friends of mine who went in directions that, you know, where they lost their lives. I knew people who were my peers and comrades in SDS who died in this explosion, who went into Weatherman and died in the explosion, and, you know, 11th Street. I have people who I knew who were serving life sentences. You know, there was people in the late 60s who were in the left, you know, went in, you know, were driven into despair and rage in some pretty powerful ways. And I think history kept me from jumping off the cliff.
One of the stories I love in White Boy is your story of the oral exam, your PhD oral exam. Maybe you can take some time.
Oh, God. Okay. I think this was probably in the fall of 1969 or the early spring, when there were still building occupations going on the Columbia campus. And I had my oral exam ready, and I had asked Mark Rudd and Lewis Cole, who were the two major leaders of the Columbia SDS chapter, if they could please not occupy Fairweather Hall. If they could, you know, I knew they were going to do a building occupation. I planned to join it, but if they could please not occupy the building I was having my orals in. So I walk onto campus, and I'm wearing my, you know, sport jacket and tie, trying to look professional. I still had that professorial personality I could pull out for you know, this occasion. And Mark and Lou say, you know, Mark, I'm sorry, we got to occupy Fairweather, but what we'll do is, when we occupy the building, we'll throw everybody else out and let your orals go on. So I go in, and here I am. There's Richard Hofstadter, Walter Metzger, Eric Foner, Richard Cloward, and Alan Silver. It's a very distinguished lineup. And they start asking me questions. All of a sudden, I hear breaking glass, furniture being smashed, people screaming in the hallway outside, plaster, you know, is starting to fall. And I realize this, all hell is breaking loose in the building, but nobody touches us. And this is going on. They're asking me questions for 2 hours. And I have this sense of utter unreality with this. Of course, I'm also pretty confident I'm going to pass. When it's over, I realize this building is barricaded, and there's no way to get out except through a window. So I escort Richard. I escort all these people out through the window of the lounge in Fairweather Hall, where there are people down below to make sure they don't get hurt. Then I go back home, change into my movement clothes, and come back in through the window to finish the occupation. So that was my oral exam. It shows that nepotism exists even in the left.
What was their response to this whole experience?
I think that Alan Silver was deeply offended. I think it really upset him. I thought Richard Hofstadter thought it was hilarious. As I said, he looked at me as sort of almost, you know, himself, you know, he had a radical youth which he looked at benignly on. And I think that, so I don't think that he was upset by this. I mean, even though he was very critical of building occupations, very skeptical that the left could achieve its goals, but I think he also had a sense that there, you know, people are, can be radical in their youth, and this is not a bad thing. And he I really felt he had that sort of ironic distance from it. That was I found a very wonderful thing to be around.
Did he ever speak to you about his years in the Communist Party?
No. He at this time, unfortunately, he was also very, very sick. So it was that was also an issue. I mean, I felt that I was going to get really close to him, but you know, I didn't want to impose at a time when he was ill, and you know, I think there would have been a lot of conversations that we would have had, you know, had his illness not proceeded that way.